For more talks and meditations, go to GloriaKGreen.com. Digging down to your authentic self, seeing your obstacles. So we've been talking about digging for your authentic self, and we've talked about discovering what's important to you, and then charting your North Star. Who is it you really want to be? And last time we talked a little about mapping your route. But even when you map your route, there's a lot of obstacles you have to go through. So today we're going to talk about seeing the obstacles, because unless we can see the obstacles we put in our own way, we can't navigate around them. And that's what we'll talk about next time. So there's a quote, "Don't carry your mistakes around with you. Instead, place them under your feet and use them as stepping stones to rise above them." It's an anonymous quote. Use your mistakes as stepping stones to rise above them. Isn't that interesting? I would have never thought of that on my own, I don't think. All kinds of things can pull us in the wrong direction. And before we can navigate those obstacles that are in the path to our authentic self, to being who we really want to be, we have to see what those obstacles are. Sometimes other people have put the obstacles in our way, but often we put them in our way ourselves. The obstacles are like knots because they tie us up and they obstruct our freedom. They don't let us get down to see what our deepest self wants. And there's 6 different types of obstacles. There's desire and craving, anger and aversion, restlessness and worry. My favorite, just the sound of these words, sloth and torpor. Doubt and delusion. And to kind of give you an idea of what these are, I'm going to use an example from the Buddha. I know this is a secular class, but this is the best example I've ever seen. He used a pool of clear water that reflects our image. And he said, "When desire is present in the mind, it is as if the pool were suffused with the colored dye. Desire colors our perceptions. When aversion is present, it's like boiling water. We can't see clearly. We're heated up by anger. We're in a state of turbulence." Anybody ever be in a state of turbulence? Can't see what's going on? And when sloth and torpor are present, the pool is overgrown with algae. It's just kind of stagnant water and it gets real yucky. There's a stagnation of the mind to prevent us from seeing clearly. You know, you can't see to the bottom of the pool when it's got algae. And restlessness and worry are like water when it's stirred up by the wind. The mind is tossed about by agitation. The more agitated you are, the more you jump from one thing to the next without finishing anything. And doubt is like muddy water. We can't see to the bottom. Everything's obscured. So we have all of these obstacles that when there are obstacles, they're really hard for us to see. We often think we're seeing clearly. I know she meant that, but I'm angry, so I'm of course projecting my anger out on someone else. Our perceptions are also distorted by who we think we are. All those masks that we put on to keep ourselves safe, they distort our perception because we see what we think we're supposed to see. We hear what we want to hear, not what's really there. So even when we want to change, sometimes we hold on to that image. In prison, there's a lot of guys who hold on to that image of, "I'm an angry person. And that's who I am. I can't help it and I can't change." Because they're clinging so tight, they got white knuckles. that's kind of desire, even though why would you desire being angry? But that's their identity and they're holding on to it. So when you want to change, you can't because you unconsciously work against the changes you want to make in your life. How many times have you tried to lose weight or meditate more or do something else that's good for you, and you do it a couple of days and then all of a sudden you drop it? We kind of self-sabotage. And part of it is we have these high expectations, and if they don't come to fruition right away, then forget it. Part of it is we just don't want to have to do the work to get to where we want to be, so we just give up. It's pretty easy for us to fall into unconscious patterns to soothe ourselves. You know, my unconscious pattern is let's have a little chocolate in a dessert. And supposedly that soothes me. But when the chocolate's gone, I don't really feel much different than I did before I ate it. And if I'm really mindful, I'm going to start seeing that and know that reaching for chocolate isn't going to soothe me. Even when we know the paths, the habits are pulling us off the path to our authentic self. Anyone with a alcohol disorder, or into drugs, or does too much shopping, or too much doom scrolling, or distracts themselves with books, or distracts themselves with movies, to a great extent, not once in a while, but over and over and over, that's pulling you off the path to your authentic self. You're trying to cover your hurts up with something else. And when you cover them up, you can't see your authentic self. And so you're going to have to dig down at some point in time. So let's take a look at these obstacles that derail us so that we can become more aware of when they arise. Because if we can become aware of when they arise, we can see them. And then they're above the line and we can do something about it. When they're below the line and we're unconscious, they jerk us around. So the quicker we become at becoming aware of that obstacle arising, the better chance we have of making a skillful choice before our prefrontal cortex goes offline. Because once our prefrontal cortex goes offline, we're not going to make a skillful choice. We fall back on the habits that haven't worked for years, but we still do them because that's what we've always done. So instead of blindly reacting in our habitual ways, we want to look at the routine and see if it's getting us what we thought it would, which is what I've kind of been doing with chocolate. When I'm feeling kind of, I need something, I go for chocolate. And I've been paying attention that, okay, enjoy the chocolate while you eat it. Savor it because it's so good. Don't eat it while you're reading and then not even know that you had it. But then how do you feel afterwards? Did it really make a change in how you feel? Is it really working? And until I see that, I'm not going to change it. And I'm going to have to see it over and over and over because I got 60 plus years of don't feel good, eat chocolate. That neural pathway is really strong. So building the other one up is going to take some time. So the first obstacle is desire. That's our wanting mind. And there's two types of desire. There's a longing that's meaningful and healthy, that I want to get to know my true self, that I want to understand people, that I want to be a loving person. Those are longer term, they're meaningful, and they're healthy desires. The desires that are not healthy are the ones that tie us up in a knot, the ones we hold so tightly because we are afraid to let them go. So these desires are the ones that take the edge off of our discomfort. They kind of cover up our discomfort. And so they're not healthy because they're not what we really, what really would make all of us happy if we could do it is to be understanding and compassionate and kind and loving and slow down and not be reaching for all these things. We would really feel contentment, and maybe you wouldn't call it happiness, but let's call it contentment. And we wouldn't need all the things we think we need. But because that's a goal that's way out in the future for most of us, if we ever can get there, we also end up having these other desires that are going to make us feel good in the moment. So at breakfast, I've been saying, may I not use food to cover up my loneliness, my boredom, or my emptiness. Hopefully, if I keep saying that to myself, I'll start paying attention and doing that. So the first thing we want to do when we see a desire that I want something, is it healthy or is it tying us up in a knot? You know, the desire to go out and be in nature, probably healthy. Not always, because if you're always doing that at the expense of other things you need to do to live, that would be a problem. So it's not the desire itself that's healthy or unhealthy. It's our reaction to the desire. Is that tying us up in knots? Are we feeling our body tense, like, oh, I really need this? Or is it a desire that's more open and spacious? And that's what you want to look at. With healthy desires, we can hold them lightly. You can hold lightly the idea that I want to grow in love and grow in understanding. I don't feel like I have to rush out and do something right this minute. I can say, yes, I want to do that. And to do it, I need to slow down. With unhealthy desires, we kind of get rope burn. We're trying to hang on so tight. And then when it gets pulled away, we get rope burn. And the desire is really powerful then. And then we become addicted. You know, yes, maybe addicted isn't the right word, but I don't know what other word. But we get addicted to binge watching on Netflix. We get addicted to scrolling through Facebook or Instagram or whatever. We can get addicted to reading, to movies. We can get addicted to exercise. Whatever it is, when it's a really powerful desire, it can be addicting to us. And those are the ones that are not healthy. When we feel the need, like, I have to walk every day, because if I don't, or I have to run every day, or I have to do this. When you feel that I have to, that's the unhealthy desire. And that desire is just simply to cover up something that you don't want. So when you feel that desire, you don't want to push it away, because if you whack it down, it's going to come up someplace else and you're just going to play whack-a-mole. But what you want to do is get beneath it. What's going on with that? What am I feeling right now? What's the story? What am I believing? What am I feeling? What is it that I don't want to, what's making me uncomfortable that I want to cover up? And I've been asking myself that in my sits lately because I haven't wanted to sit. And I know it's because there's something, and I kind of know what it is. My kids are all in Monaco with their families and my ex, so I kind of know what it is. But it makes me, you know, oh, I don't want those feelings to come up. And then I tell myself, this has been going on for 30 plus years. You should be used to it by now. But there's no should. That's what I feel. So we don't push the desire away that we want to do something. We look underneath it. We sit with it. And we look and say, what's really going on that's causing me to desire this? And we practice what we practice if we want to change a habit, according to Judson Brewer, which is look at what is the impetus for the habit, what starts it, what's the behavior, and what's really the reward that you get. And that's kind of what I've been doing with chocolate a little bit. And it's going to take some time, but over time, I will see whether or not chocolate really is, you know, doing something good for me or not. And when it's not, then I can look to what I really need, because that takes some digging. Chocolate isn't what I really need. I need something else, but I haven't dug enough to see it. So craving comes out of the stress of unmet needs. When we have fewer dopamine receptors, we seek reward from substitutes. And so to lessen the strength of the craving, we need to look deeply and see, what's this craving trying to cover up? And that's the thing that you do with a habit. What is this habit trying to do? What's the reward I think I'm going to get? And am I really going to get that reward, or am I not? So instead of turning away from the discomfort feeling and trying to ignore it, then you have to turn toward that uncomfortable feeling and be with it and say, what desire is being fulfilled by this craving? And is it really? Is chocolate really relaxing me, or is chocolate really making me feel good? And some people would say yes, but I'm not so sure chocolate can really do that. We can enjoy it, we can savor it, but it can't make us feel different if we've got something underneath that's poking its head up at us. And so pleasant experiences kind of trick us, because we think, well, if I had this pleasant experience, life is going to be good. But that pleasant experience isn't going to last forever. And so sometimes we cling to it. You know, I don't get that much time with my grandkids. And so when they're there, I really want to spend time with them. But I have to not cling, because when they leave, I would be really sad. So I have to savor them, but not cling to them. And it's like walking on a tightrope. How do I do that? So, because if we're looking at pleasures and saying, well, if I just had a chocolate dessert, I would be fine, that's not true. Because something else is going to come up to make that, whatever I'm pushing under, pop right back up again. So we fall into the trap of if only mind. If only I could lose 5 pounds. If only the sun was shining. If only my daughter would call me more. If only I had enough money to go on a vacation. If only, if only, if only. We always want something more. When that if only comes to fruition and we get it, we want something else. And something else, because that's not the need that was unmet. That's the cover-up. So that's what desire's all about. The opposite side of the coin is aversion, the not wanting mind. Habits of aversion manifest as frustration, annoyance, impatience, anger, judgment. We feel like we're defending ourselves, we're resisting a threat, or we're protecting ourselves. We put our defenses up when we have aversion. We're protecting ourselves so we don't get harmed. We often feel tightness, tension, contraction, agitation, or other fight or flight sensations. When we're in aversion, we're pretty much in fight or flight. And the thoughts and beliefs in our mind urge us to act in a way that's going to change that unpleasant situation or experience. So we need to change it as soon as possible, because it's making us uncomfortable, whatever it is. We strike against the experience, pushing it away and rejecting it. Does that work? When you push something away? Most of the time, what we do is we give ourselves the second arrow. The first arrow is something's happening that we don't like. The second arrow is we add to the pain by telling us, woe is me, I'm the victim, this always happens to me. And then we remember the 25 other times that we didn't get what we wanted. And then we just make ourselves feel worse and worse. And at this point, it's not the disappointment that we didn't get what we wanted, the party wasn't as fun as we thought it was going to be, that's making us upset. It's the stories that we're telling ourselves about all the things that we didn't get that we wanted. And we're repeating those judgments over and over instead of living in the present moment. I don't know about you, but there have been times where I've gone out to dinner or gone to a party, and I had something in my mind of how it was going to be, and it wasn't like that, and you keep trying to make it be like that, and it's just not like that. And you miss out on the whole present moment and all the good things that did happen because you're trying to make it into something else. So Tara Brach says, there's a world of difference between the wisdom of discernment and the aversion of judgment. The wisdom of discernment, this isn't right, or the aversion of judgment, I don't like this. Discernment tells us when I insist on having things my way, my partner withdraws and becomes cold and distant. That's discernment. Judgment says wanting things my own way means I'm a selfish, bad person. So it's okay to use discernment, that's wise, to say this isn't for me. But to judge it and say this is bad and this person is bad because they were trying to give me this that I don't want, that's judgment. And I don't know about you, but my neural pathways for judgment are way stronger than I'd like them to be. And I really have to work at letting them atrophy a little. So aversion struggles to get rid of something. If we just let go of the story, it could just fade in the background all on its own. But when we're aversive, we start ruminating about it should have been like this, it should have been like that. And we do all the coulda, shoulda, wouldas. But no matter how many coulda, woulda, shouldas we do, we can't change the past. It's going to be the way it is. We kind of pretend like it's we let go and that everything's okay. You know, there's a number of people use that. It's all good. No, it is not all good. There's some bad and there's some good. It's not all good. When we're saying that, we're pretending, we're lying to ourselves. We have to say, there are some things I don't like, but that's not the whole world. That's not the whole picture. If we don't accept that this is reality and fully feel it, we can't let go. You know, many of us have to accept the full reality that we're aging. And if we don't accept that reality, we can't let go of wanting to be like we were when we were 20. But we're not 20 anymore. And we're never going to be 20 again. Even if your anger is justified, you can let go of it. Accept it and feel it. We talked about that when we talked about rain. Recognize, allow, investigate, or nurture. When I was at prison, we were talking about rain last week, and I realized I like admit for the A. Admit this is your reality in the moment. If we can admit it and feel it, it's not so scary and it loses some of its power over us. By letting go, we don't let our anger consume us. Because holding on to your anger is like holding on to a hot coal. You're the one who's getting burned, not the person that made you angry. But that's really hard because sometimes anger feels really good in the short run. When you're angry at someone and you yell at them, it feels good. It feels strong. But afterwards, if you're mindful afterwards, you don't quite feel so good. Usually there's a lot of regret. So when we're angry, frustrated, or annoyed, our aversion contracts us and puts our blinders on us, so we don't see all the skillful choices we can make. When we're angry, we don't see the skillful choices. All we want to do is lash out and get back at and get revenge. We spend countless hours imagining what we're going to say the next time we see that so-and-so. Or playing scenarios in our mind of what we could have said. And the angrier we are, the more likely we are to either shut down, my specialty, just shut down, or bulldoze ahead, ignoring any opposing views. Just, nope, I'm angry, and this is what I want, and this is how it's going to be, and bulldoze away. Everyone else be damned. This is it. Thich Nhat Hanh says, you may get angry very easily because the seed of anger has been watered too often in the past. Anybody's seeds of anger get watered regularly? When you begin to cultivate the energy of mindfulness, the first insight we have is that the main course of our suffering, of our misery, is not the other person. It's the seed of anger in us. We often blame our anger on the other person. Any five-year-old, why did you do that? He made me angry. No, he didn't make you angry. He watered the seed of anger that's already in you, and you have control over it. But we forget that. It's us and the way we're perceiving things that make us angry. Because sometimes what the other person did is totally innocent and totally good. But we get angry because we have a wrong perception. The third obstacle that we have to get over is restlessness and worry. Sometimes we feel like we have ants in our pants. This restlessness, there's agitation, there's nervousness, anxiety, there's worry. We just, something's not right, and we just got to do something. We're often worried about the future, or we're fretting about the past, and we're constantly searching for things to do because we need to get rid of some of this pent-up energy that we have. We could just lengthen our exhale and exhale some of that restlessness, but we usually don't think of it. We think, I've got to do. When we have that feeling of agitation, we kind of bounce around from one thing to the next. Ever have a day where you start to clean your house and you start on this and then you stop and then you start over here and you stop and you start over here and you don't get anything done, but you got a lot of things started, or you jump from one thing to another? We start lots of things but don't finish them because something else looks more attractive. Well, really, I should do this first, or I should do that first. And sometimes when we're planning our life and who we want to be and what we want to do, we start to do something like we know would be good for us, like meditate. But then we think, oh, but you know what? This is going to bring me farther. This is better. I should go for a walk, or I should exercise, or I should read this book about mindfulness, or I should do something. And we find all these other things that look attractive to us. And so we start all sorts of things that look attractive, but we never get any farther because we're just all wound up. We're always looking for the next best thing. It's like we're the fear of missing out. If I, if I'm talking with someone at a party and I'm restless, I'm probably looking around saying, who else can I talk to? Who am I missing out on talking to? Because this person isn't doing it for me. It happens to all of us. And we miss out on what's happening in the present moment because we're busy kind of trying to listen in on other conversations to see if there's another one that maybe we want to join that's going to be more interesting than the conversation we're in. We distract ourselves when we're restless. We have to watch TV, surf the internet, or my favorite, get lost in doing. You know, when my kids are gone, boy, does my house get clean. When they were young, doesn't so much anymore because they're gone anyway. We feel like something terrible is going to happen if we don't keep moving. Do you ever feel that way? If I don't keep doing something, something bad's going to happen. And what actually happens is that we're going to feel something that we pushed below the line because we played whack-a-mole and it's going to come up again and again, but we don't want it to. And so we're restless and agitated because we don't want to deal with it. The other side of the coin, so restlessness is way too much energy. So we can exhale it out. Sloth and torpor are not enough energy. So we increase the length of our inhale to bring us a little bit more energy. I like these words because they clearly spell out the physical and mental dullness or sluggishness you feel. Sloth and torpor. We've all experienced that feeling of boredom and low energy, where you're bored and you want to do something, but nothing sounds good, and you just don't have the energy to do anything. The pandemic, for a lot of people, brought on those feelings of sloth and torpor, because all of a sudden, you weren't go, go, go. And we weren't used to it, so we just dropped down into, okay, I've got no energy. We lacked all that stimulation. And when you got sloth and torpor, you feel lazy, you feel dull. Sometimes you feel like your brain is all just foggy or sleepy. It's sleepy even though you've had enough sleep. It's not sleepy because you've deprived yourself of sleep. And when that happens, our minds become unworkable and cloudy. You know, when your brain is all foggy, you can't really think well. Sometimes sloth and torpor are due to physical causes like not getting enough sleep or exercising too much till you're exhausted or even the postprandial coma that comes after eating way too much. But if that's not the case, it's probably due to exhausting ourselves by pushing away the unpleasant feelings, those feelings that we had aversion to that we didn't want to feel, or the unpleasant beliefs or the unpleasant thoughts. When we keep pushing them down, that takes energy. And if you're using up all your energy there, you don't have the energy to do the things that are going to move you towards your North Star. The final obstacle is doubt. There's two kinds of doubt. There's the helpful doubt, where you scrutinize things. And there's the unhelpful doubt, where you're wavering, second-guessing, and getting paralyzed by indecision. You're just, I just don't know. And with helpful doubt, we're using wise discernment to see what's true so we can make a skillful decision. With unhelpful doubt, we just get on the merry-go-round of excessive skepticism and indecision. We just can't make a decision. You know, oh, I don't know if I should meditate now, or maybe it's better if I wait and meditate in the afternoon, and then we don't do anything. We make a decision by not making a decision. So when we're in unhelpful doubt, we just don't know which path to take. And there's so many paths we could take, but we're stuck, we're paralyzed. We don't take any of them. And part of that is because human beings love certainty. And I don't know that anyone loves certainty more than I love certainty. Sometimes we'd rather have bad news than no news at all because we like to know what's going on. And if I don't know if I'm going in the right direction, then sometimes I don't want to take a step in that direction because I hate being wrong. And if doubt's telling me that might not be the right way to go, then I'm just standing there looking and trying to decide. It's like you're standing in the middle of the street and you need to figure out where exactly you're at because you don't have Google Maps. But you have to walk up to the next corner to see what the two street signs are before you can really know where you're at. But you're standing there saying, well, I don't know which way to go. You know, do I go to the right or the left to see the street signs to see where I'm at? So you just stand there and try and guess what to do, and you're just stuck. So doubt can just really be paralyzing for you. And so if you're doubting that you're on the right path or that this is the way you want to go, then you're not going to do it. I have had times where I've had a lot of doubt. Is meditation really the right thing to do? Because once you see things, you cannot unsee them. And there are times where it's just like, well, really, if I've been wasting my time meditating and practicing this mindfulness, and the longer I've done it, the less the doubt. But I tell you, in my first couple of years, it's just like, well, is this really a good use of my time? You know, I was busy, had kids at home, was working full time. Is this really, you know? So there's a lot of second guessing. And you have to just stop and see that and say, okay, this is doubt. It's keeping me from doing something. I should just take a step in one direction or the other and see how it feels. Because I can always turn around and begin again. And the last one is delusion. Delusion is not seeing reality as it is. Delusion is thinking, I could run Sitnamai again. It's a 20-mile race. Not going to happen. And delusion, sometimes what we see and what we hear is distorted by our beliefs and our biases. Someone says something to us, and we take it the wrong way. And then we're really angry because how dare they do that when it's not what they meant at all. Other times we have very selective perception. We only see what we want to see and listen to what we want to hear. You know, my sisters had told me after my father passed away, I was the favorite. But I couldn't believe that. I couldn't listen to that because I had this bias in my head that he said, what's that bee doing there, meant he thought I wasn't good enough. And until I got past that bias, past that delusion, I couldn't see or hear what they were saying. So we have a lot of faulty and selective perceptions. We think we see the whole picture when we only see part of it. We say, I'm an angry person. Well, an angry person is part of who you are. But if you could get rid of some of those masks that are making you come across as the angry person, you might find there's a teddy bear inside. You know, I know I've met a number of guys, especially, who come across as macho, whatever, when deep down inside, you know, they're as soft as can be and as sweet as can be, but they can't show it. So we have all that. We think we see the whole picture of who someone is, but we only see part of it. And the biggest problem with delusion is that we think we can control things that we can't control. We wouldn't try to control the weather because we know that's not going to happen. But there's things we try and control. If he would just do this, and we want to make other people live according to our expectations, and then we can be happy. Or we think that if I can just keep this pleasant experience going on and on, make it last forever, I can't do that. But on the flip side, the unpleasant experience is not going to last forever either. So let's not be delusional about that, because that's a good way to get you very upset, thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be terrible. It's never going to end. It's always going to be awful. So when we're delusional, we try and change things from rough and tangled to more steady and buoyant, but we're not using our prefrontal cortex and doing it skillfully. When we're delusional, we're just plowing ahead like a bull in a china shop. And all you need to do is see the delusions. To get rid of darkness, all you need to do is flip on the light switch. You don't have to get rid of the darkness. We think, well, I got to get rid of all the negative things in me before I can see through my delusions. No, all you have to do is see that the delusions may not be true. You'll know it's a delusion because your mind's going to react either with greed or with aversion. You're going to really want it or you're going to hate it. And there's not going to be a middle ground when it's delusional. And as we peel off the delusion layers, we find the goodness and the love that are deep down inside of us. That's that digging that D.H. Lawrence talks about. Trevor Moad says, neutral thinking strips away the bull and the biases, both external and internal. There are more biases in this world than there are fruit flies and gnats combined. They're everywhere you look, many of them buzzing around your psyche right now. Confirmation bias, selection bias, negativity bias, recency bias, gender bias, optimism bias, pessimism bias. It's hard to clearly perceive reality when your subconscious is busy prejudicing it. There's a lot of our subconscious prejudicing what we see and what we hear. The great American philosopher Henry David Thoreau had a name for this state of delusion. He called it slumbering through life. As he saw it, we get so caught up in the shams and delusions of the mind that we miss reality, what's happening right here and right now. So we all experience these obstacles at some point in our lives. But some of them end up on our top 10 list of thoughts more often. Take a few minutes to reflect on which of these obstacles are more likely to pull you away from your path to your North Star. In our next session, we'll discuss how to navigate around these obstacles. Until then.